Hi, this is We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network on the internet. We're broadcasting from two shipping containers at Roberta's Pizza, 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. That is our theme music that you're listening to, thanks to Paul Watling of SuperCompuGlobal.com. So I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are Groundworks, Inc., garden design, installation, and maintenance company located here in Brooklyn. And this show, We Dig Plants, aims to bring the culture to horticulture. You can check us out at our website, groundworksgardens.com, to learn more about what we do. Or please join our Facebook page, Groundworks, Inc., We Dig Plants. So today, we're going to have a sequel, part two of last week's show, Tropical Houseplants. There's so much to cover in this genre, I guess. Fertilizers, soil, pests, where to buy. It just goes on and on. And last week we didn't have enough time to talk. So
that's right.
So today we are going to continue where we ended last week. And we're going to talk about a few of the plants that I had to quickly skim over. Some fragrant plants. So the first I want to talk about is citrus. So that we don't get scurvy in this late January, early February, lack of light. we make sure that we're getting our vitamin C. The first thing you need to consider with a citrus plant is the size of the plant. You have to consider the size of the pot that's necessary. These can be large trees, as you know, or they can be ornamental size, specifically grown for indoor environments. So the ever-bearing citrus varieties, Citrus limonaria, are marketed as ever-bearing because they're an excellent plant for house culture. It produces fruits freely. And we recommend such varieties as a Meyer lemon, a lime, sour orange, grapefruit, kumquat, mandarin, and limequat. I'm not swearing. That's really a word.
Limequat. Is that a new cultivar that's a cross between a squat and a
it's lime? Short? No. It's a kumquat and a lime.
That's great. And yeah. It's sweet?
It's kind of sweet sour, which is really cool. Nice. So rules of thumb for citrus. Use a general purpose soil that is slightly acidic and keep the temperatures of the environment between 55 and 70 degrees. A south-facing window is preferable. They like cool nights and warm days. So the other thing you need to know about citrus, which is extremely important, is high humidity.
Aren't they native to the Southeast Asia, right? The tropics?
Exactly. So you have to think about, you know, conditions that would emulate such. So think of Florida, think of the Caribbean, think of Hawaii. You can use a humidifier. And if you don't want to fake the climate in your house to mimic this condition, you can spray it daily with just a 99-cent spray bottle. But you will spend a lot of time spraying. So that's why a humidifier works. Do not let this plant dry out. You can touch the top of the soil often and make sure that the soil stays moist. The other thing you want to do is have good drainage. They do not like to sit in water. So there could be some bugs that happen with citrus, and that's because of poor air circulation. So basically what you want to do is keep a fan nearby, and that will also reduce the amount of white fly and spider mites. Now, Carmen's going to talk in a few minutes about pests, but as a general rule, you can use a non-toxic insecticidal soap, and Carmen will talk more about that. So one final note about citrus, there's some very good news. In October that just passed, the USDA just lifted the 3-year ban. So now citrus can be shipped from Florida. So get your citrus and get it fast, matey. Another great fragrant house plant that a lot of our clients always ask us about is rosemary. So the key to growing this plant is to get it acclimated to the lower light conditions of the house versus the outdoor full sunlight conditions as it grows in the garden. It's best to get this plant in the spring. Keep it outside in the summer, and then in fall, as the light wanes and the temperatures drop, do not let this plant sit outside below 30 degrees. You can slowly move the plant into less lit areas for a few weeks before you bring it inside. This plant, rosemary, needs 6 to 8 hours of sunlight in the windowsill. So you should rotate the plant weekly so that it gets full exposure. And southern exposure works best.
And that is one of the few plants that doesn't want a lot of humidity in the indoors,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's why it's great for apartment living, because it likes it dry and hot. The only thing you have to really worry about is the drafty cold windowsill, because it doesn't like
that much cold,
the temperature fluctuation. It may get powdery mildew, which is a white kind of powder-like film that covers the leaves. And again, this is caused from a lack of air circulation, so a small fan will help with that. And hopefully it will bloom for you. The colors are blue, pink, and purple, and that will sweeten the pot even more. So two last things about rosemary that I found kind of interesting when I was reading a great book called The Potted Garden, which is the history of indoor plants. And I'll post that on our Facebook page. Rosemary was called the guard robe because of its insecticidal attribute in keeping pests, moths, away from the clothing.
When people didn't bathe as much?
Exactly, exactly. And also, when people didn't bathe so much, it was used during the plague to keep a person safe as they entered areas of infection. It was stuffed into pouches and secured onto walking sticks so that when people walked through an infirmary, they didn't catch the evils.
So they thought that the smell would protect them.
Exactly.
From the plague. Plus, it also protected them from the rotting corpses.
Exactly.
The smell of the rotting corpses.
They thought that the plague was an airborne condition, but and that's why they would surround their faces with, they actually invented masks to stuff the rosemary in to kind of ward against this. So we're going to take a break. Carmen's going to come back and she's going to talk about some more specific information.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. That was Rosemary by Herb Alberts Tijuana. I'm Carmen DeVito, and we are going to talk some more about houseplants. Last week, we weren't able to cover everything that we wanted to, and we just kind of whet your appetite. So now we're going to delve a little deeper and give you some more information and tips to help you succeed. We're going to talk first about the needs of indoor plants. The first is light, and that seems obvious, but why light? Well, light is necessary for photosynthesis, which is how a plant manufactures food for its life processes, its growth, its flowering, its fruiting. And light is a factor that you can affect as a gardener, either indirectly or directly, by understanding how much light you have and analyzing it. And I'm going to kind of break it out into three components of light that will help you understand how much light you actually have for your plant to thrive in. The first component of light is its intensity, which means which direction is it coming from, north, south, east, or west. And then its duration. How long does the light actually penetrate into your home from the window? And what you have to think about when you think about the duration is buildings, obstacles, overhangs, those affect how much light actually come in. Do you lower the blinds or close the drapes during the day? You may think that you have a sunny window, but if you forget that you shut the blinds every time you leave the house, the plant isn't getting enough light, perhaps. another component of light, it's its quality. Not all glass is the same. Some is clear, some is tinted, frosted, some is actually coated with a UV blocking material to protect interiors and to control the temperature indoors. Sometimes you might be living in an apartment building and not even realize that the windows are tinted because you don't see it. It doesn't really affect how much light you see. But
great for your art, but
not necessarily for your plants. And another, you know, seems like an obvious thing, but is the glass clean? If your windows are really dirty, you might be blocking as much as 50% of the light from penetrating into your into your home. And that, of course, the plants will be sensitive to. A more direct and scientific measure of light are foot candles. And that is usually measured by a light meter, like something that you'd have, you know, in your camera. But people aren't walking around their apartments with light meters measuring how many foot candles are in each area. So I've come up with basically, you know, some guidelines in evaluating how much light you have without using a light meter. The best light is in a southern, southeast, or southwest window. Then comes east or west. And then the least amount of light would be in a north, northwest, or northeast window. That's where there's the least amount of light, the lowest duration, and the lowest intensity.
That's why it's important to know the name of your plant and where it naturally occurs in habitat so that you can place plants appropriately.
Right. And another factor to consider is the location in the room. Corners and walls on either side of the window where people sometimes think, oh, I'm going to put it next to the window and it's getting a lot of light. Actually, that's one of the most shaded parts of the room.
Or next to my couch because it looks good there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also light in the corners opposite a window is also a pretty poor amount of light. So for simplicity's sake, I've broken out into three basic level. So when you buy a plant, you can kind of try to figure out which category it falls into. If a plant says it needs full sun, like the rosemary that Alice was talking about, you want to put it in a south, southeast, or southwest window. If a plant says that it requires indirect light or diffuse light, that's
like the philodendron from
exactly,
last week's show.
Exactly. That's light coming through a thick curtain or a partial shade, like indoors away from a window.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some plants that really tolerate low light, like the Sansevierias or other things that we talked about last week. You can put those in a room that probably doesn't even have a window and it just has sort of reflected light. That's considered low light plants, mm-hmm. like pothos and some philodendrons. On average, most plants prefer diffused light. So most houseplants would prefer you know, near a window, but through a thick curtain.
Right.
Now, another need of plants, obviously, is soil. And there's many different components of soil, and they have different roles in the needs of the plant. The first, of course, is compost or shredded bark. That's the organic part of the soil. That provides nutrients and structure for the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Another component might be peat moss, and that retains moisture and also sometimes improves structure. A third component that you sometimes might find is charcoal, and that's used in growing epiphytes that Alice talked about last week.
Air plants.
Exactly.
Without soil.
And that has absorptive and also disinfectant properties.
Those are good for terrariums.
Yes. In fact, you can put it in any, you can even put it at the bottom of a vase for cut flowers. It keeps the water a little cleaner. Another component might be sphagnum moss, which is that sort of spongy, stringy moss. And that's used for growing a lot of carnivorous plants or orchids like that. It retains moisture, but it still drains really well.
It's also kind of a decorative element. Is that right, too?
It can be used. Another part, sometimes you'll see things growing in something called osmunda fiber. It's brown and kind of crunchy and dry. That stuff is made from the roots of the royal fern, and it's usually used to grow orchids. And the reason they use it to grow orchids is because it doesn't rot easily and it also drains really well. Most houseplants are not grown in that. Then there's perlite. That's that stuff that looks like styrofoam that's in soil, but it's actually a mineral that's kind of been exploded, and that's used for drainage. And then there's vermiculite, which is also a mineral. That's that black, sparkly kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's very light, and it adds in drainage. And then recently, growers have been using styrofoam peanuts as a lightening and drainage material and growing orchids and other things that really, really need good drainage. And I can't stress that enough. Very few plants do well in stagnant soil.
Right. We actually use that too in like a decorative pot that you want to kind of hide your plastic pot. If you just put a couple of inches of the styrofoam, then the plastic plant sits up higher, but there's decent drainage.
Exactly. So those are the visible components of the soil. The microscopic and parts are, you know, beyond the scope of this show today, but they're equally important, all the microbes and everything. Another need of plants, Alice touched on that in her discussion earlier, was humidity. As we said in the last show, most plants prefer a humidity level of 50 to 60%, and our homes average 5 or 10%. So it's very important to increase the humidity in the ways that Alice suggested, remembering that plants absorb water not just from their roots, but also from their epidermis, their scales, and their hairs.
You said epidermis.
I did. I was waiting for a chance to say that. And then they return the moisture back into the atmosphere through transpiration at night. So if you have a really dry environment, the plant's suffering, mm-hmm. and they'll be much too dry. Now, a lot of times people think that their plant is drying out and drying out from lack of water. They see some of the distress signals, like browning of tips and leaves. That's not necessarily too little water in the soil. It might be too low humidity. So don't just dump more water on it thinking that that's the problem. It might just be the humidity. And Alice touched on another component, and that's air circulation. We can't stress that enough. Plants live naturally outdoors. There's wind, there's air movement, and you can't keep it in an airtight apartment like
a little
box. No, that will cause diseases, fungal problems, and sometimes insect problems mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. So it's good to put the fan on, even if you don't feel like having it on for yourself, but for your plants, it's really important. Or if it's not too cold out, crack open the window to try to bring in some fresh air. So we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the nutrients that plant needs and maybe some pests that affect plants.
Ladybug, ladybug, been away so long. The winter is over, the snow is gone. The flowers are growing, leaves in the tree. Ladybug, come back please. Ladybug, ladybug, where did you go in your little red coat?
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking about house plants again, where they come from, what to do with them, and how to take care of them. That music that you were just listening to was Ladybug by Jack Grunsky. So we talked about the needs of plants, and we can't forget about nutrients. We all take our vitamins, we all try to eat a healthy diet, and unfortunately our plants can't tell us what they need. Sometimes they give us clues, but they're not as communicative as maybe a dog might be. So the first source of nutrients, and probably the most important for plants, is soil, good soil. Last time we talked about not digging up some soil in your garden and just potting your plant in it. It's best to use sterilized soil.
Available at any kind of garden center.
Exactly. That has some organic component to it. So if you use good soil, you usually don't need to fertilize very frequently or right away when you first get a plant, but you usually need some supplemental fertilizer. And that's because the plant will use up what's in the soil. And when you every time you water, some nutrients leach out. So I'm going to talk about the major components of fertilizer. The first is nitrogen. That's usually represented by an N on the bag. And nitrogen is used by the plant for strong and vigorous growth and for good leaf color and, of course, for photosynthesis. The second component is phosphorus, usually represented by a P on the bag. And that's used by the plant for good root growth and for ripening of fruit, if it has fruit, seed capsules. And the third component is potassium, represented by a K. Remember that from the chart in fifth grade science?
Yeah.
The periodic table.
That has now become a t-shirt, I think.
Yes. And potassium helps in the formation of fruit and the uptake of other nutrients. Now, there are secondary and micronutrients and also trace elements like calcium and magnesium that the plant needs as well. So what do the numbers on the bag mean? Usually there's like 5-10-5 or 3-2-1.
10-10-10.
Exactly. How do you know which one to buy when you're shopping? Well, each number is a percentage of each nutrient. For example, if the bag has the numbers 15-15-15 on it, that means that in that bag, as a percentage of volume, there's 15% of nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium. The rest is just filler. Mm-hmm. So it's in that order. The first number is the nitrogen, the second is phosphorus, and the third is potassium. Now, a lot of discussion about organic versus synthetic fertilizers. And how do you define organic?
Here we go.
Okay.
Take it away, Carmen.
Take it. Ta-da! In scientific terms, anything that contains carbon is considered organic, right? But as gardeners, we have a very different definition of what organic means. So it's important to read the label really carefully.
Organic has become a political term at this point.
Yes. A battering ram, a big stick, lots of things. If the label lists sources such as kelp, bat guano, bone meal, etc., that's usually a clue that it's organically sourced. Mm-hmm. And also another clue is if the ratio of the numbers is less than 15, it's probably organically based. Organic fertilizers don't have as much concentrated nutrients. So if it has like 3, 2, and 1, it might be organic. If it has 30, 50, and 20, it's probably synthetic. Mm-hmm. Now, why would you want to use an organic versus synthetic fertilizer? Well, the organic fertilizers have certain advantages. First of all, they're slowly broken down and absorbed by the plant. And secondly, they usually have traces of micronutrients that mm-hmm. synthetics don't.
Fungi and good exactly. bacteria.
And they also improve the structure of the soil. Each year, Alice and I put compost on all of the gardens that we make. That's usually the most fertilizer that we put on. And that improves the plants and actually prevents a lot of problems. So they improves the structure of the soil as well as give nutrients. Now, synthetic and chemical fertilizers, those are synthesized from coal, gas, and also petrochemicals. And as I said, they're far more concentrated than organics. And they're designed to meet the immediate needs of the plants.
Right, which is why you see a lot of bloom and not a lot of green sometimes.
Yeah, so when you use Miracle-Gro, those little spray things, it is true, the plant might triple in size, mm-hmm. you know, within a couple of weeks.
But is it good for the roots and the longevity and the sustainability of that plant?
Probably
right. not.
No, it causes fast, mm-hmm. but sometimes weak growth. That actually might hurt the plant, and it might actually make them prone to disease and pests.
So you're saying it's the McDonald's of fertilizer?
Well, yeah, maybe. So they don't really enhance the soil. And in fact, what we found is that using synthetics exclusively may actually cause the soil to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I would use exclusively. And of course, you know, this is something that there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, all over the place on this radio station and others. Excess runoff from chemical fertilizers on farms causes water pollution. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that you can really ignore. Now, the final thing that I'm going to talk about in terms of plant needs, and it'll be obvious, but it bears noting, is water. Water is necessary for photosynthesis. You cannot have it without it. And it's important for all life processes, plants and animals alike. So you want to try to avoid hard water. And you want to try to use room temperature water, not really extremes of cold or hot. Now, we've come to what every plant owner runs across, a pest at some point or another.
Sometimes the pest is the plant owner.
Yes. There's furry pests and there's six-legged pests.
And there's pests that water too much and yeah. don't understand the
And there's pesky gardeners
needs
and there's
of their
pesky opinions. but the pests that I'm going to talk about are insect pests. And in terms of indoor plants, there's what I like to call the four top offenders.
Is there like a wanted poster of
these
guys?
There should be. Yeah. There should be. So blown up so people can identify them. And I'm going to name them all. Aphids, mealybugs, scale, and spider mites. Those are the four pests that usually affect indoor plants. And they're most prevalent in the winter when the plants, when there's, you know, low humidity and less light.
This would make a good comic book series, I think.
It would. I wonder, I would like to be the aphid, I think.
I want to be the ladybug.
Mm-hmm. So aphids, those are usually, they're the biggest, and they're the most easily identifiable. They come in great colors, like green and gray and black and orange, and they're pear-shaped. They have pear-shaped bodies. Now, out in the garden, they have many pests that can eat them, like ladybugs, and even ants milk some aphids. But indoors, you're not going to probably release praying mantis. You're not going to release bugs. So how do you, you know, how do you deal with them? Well, you have to find them first. And they're usually found on the plant tips and the flower buds. They love that new, young, soft growth. It's so tasty.
Innocent flesh.
Mm-hmm. Just waiting there, waiting to be chewed on. And that's what they do. They weaken the plants by chewing, and also by depositing their honeydew, which is a horrible name for insect poop. They deposit their honeydew onto the plant, and that causes disease. So insects not only damage their plant by chewing and sucking, but they also bring and harbor disease, which mm-hmm. can cause many problems. So how do you deal with them? Well, you want to usually hose them off with strong jets of water, and you want to hand clean the foliage. But if that doesn't work, then you might want to spray with insecticidal soap. We talked about insecticidal soap, and you can make your own. There's like lots of recipes for it, but you can usually just buy it. And it's a soap and water solution.
Right. If you wanted to make your own, a little dish soap, a quarter percentage of dish soap to water, and a Q-tip, that's the easiest way
of doing it. So mealybugs are big. You can see them, and you can usually, they're mobile. You can see them moving around. You can get rid of them. Another insect that doesn't really look like an insect is a mealybug. And a lot of people say it kind of looks like cotton, you know, mm-hmm. and it's round or oval. And the bugs themselves are encased in this cotton-like fluff. And they like to hide out in clusters in the leaflets or on the stems or where the stem meets the leaf. And they like to be protected in there. And what they do is they literally suck the plant to death.
Carm, you're getting very excited about this.
I know. I'm going to try to calm down. And how do you deal with them, these suckers? Well, as Alice said, take a Q-tip, dip it in water or a very dilute alcohol solution or soap solution, and you want to wash the plant clean. You want to remove every trace of it. Otherwise, it will just come back. And they...
I'm going to get you, sucker.
Yeah. So you want to use sprays only on the larval or crawling stage. It doesn't work on them when they're in that cottony stage. Next is the scale insect that looks a lot like a mealybug. It's stationary and brown or black, and they also attach themselves and do the same thing. They exude honeydew, they create sooty mold, and you also want to physically remove them with soap or spray them when they're in their larval stage. Now, the last is the spider mites, and they're the trickiest to deal with. They're the smallest, and how do you know you have them? You'll see webbing on the plant, or you'll see very tiny dots. Now, they love really dry conditions, so if you use, you know, if you keep the humidity up, you probably won't get them, but if you do get them, it's best to try to wash them off, remove the webbing, and really increase the humidity on them because they're very resistant to insecticides. So that covers the insect part of the houseplant discussion, and Alice and I are going to post some more information on our Facebook fan page.
And some sources.
Some great sources. Last week we listed some mail order sources, and we'll list some more this week. We'd like to thank you for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we'd like to thank Whole Foods as our sponsor. Today's show was produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. And we'd like you to join us on our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants. We'd love your feedback, and we'll be posting today's tips. Thanks for listening. See you in the garden.
Happy gardening.